Good evening from Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm Kristen Welker of NBC News, and I welcome you to the final 2020 presidential debate between President Donald J. Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden.
In a year like no other, it's hardly surprising that the U.S. presidential election has, so far, been like no other.
Hi, perhaps you recognize me. It's your favorite president.
Vote now.
Are you gonna pack the
Make
court?
Sure you, in fact, let people know you're a senator. I'm not going to answer the question.
Why
because,
would you answer that
because
question?
Because the
you
question
put a
is,
lot of
the question
Supreme Court
is,
justice,
the
radical left.
Will you
who
shut
is
up,
on,
man?
Listen, who is on your list?
The next U.S. president, leader of the free world, is going to be one of these two men.
That really is a terrifying thought. But should we in the UK really be interested? And what do the promises being made by both candidates really mean for the economy and investments in the coming months? I'm John Heumann.
And I'm Megan Boxall, and this is Not Your Normal Finance Show. But first, here's Neil Wilson to provide an overview of the situation so far.
What we've been looking at mainly is the change in the polling data over the last sort of few months, and what that is telling the market is going to happen. And I think you know, clearly Biden's got this sort of strong lead nationally. That's undisputed. And then Trump is a lot closer in the battleground states. But I think there's a real sense, certainly from the betting markets, it's still very much Joe Biden is likely to win.
You know, it looks like Biden's going to win, as you say, but Trump has also made lots of noises that, you know, he will not go quietly.
Yeah, I think that was that's been overstated, I think, the risk of that. And I think, you know, when I was a couple of months ago, we were looking at that, and that was, for a time, I would say, the number one risk. But that risk has subsided over the last few weeks, and we think that Donald Trump is not going to contest the election in any meaningful way. There might be some lawsuits, you know, or recounts in maybe the, you know, somewhere like Florida, say, but that's not a significant problem. In that, you know, we've seen that before when in 2000 with Bush v. Gore. I think there was a sort of implication that Trump would sort of almost launch a coup. I mean, that was the kind of chatter, and I think that was just totally overstating the likelihood of anything like that happening. And then also, I think when you look at the way that the postal votes are being counted, a lot of them are being counted beforehand anyway. There's only a couple of states where they can vote after the election. And we think that probably the only state where the demographics are such that, and I have to, our friends at Blonde Money did some research on this for us, and they said that, you know, the demographics are such that only Florida really presents a real risk of a real contest happening where there's a disputed result.
I mean, polls have got it wrong in the past. I mean, you know, they got it wrong when Trump came to power 4 years ago. The polls got it wrong on Brexit. You know, is there a chance that the polls have got it wrong again?
I think the polls are better. They're better than they used to be. They're more accurate. But yeah, there's definitely a chance. And I think that if you look in the key battlegrounds, are certainly getting to the point where within a margin, you're within the margin for error area, you know, around 4 points difference. And Donald Trump was at this stage in 2016, Donald Trump was about 4 points behind Hillary Clinton in the battleground states, which is where he is now. So there is a chance. I think what's on Biden's side is probably that there's a lot more people voting this time. You know, the Democrats have got the vote out, and they're already queuing. I was watching the news last night, and in Florida, they're queuing for hours round multiple blocks to cast their votes already. And this is like 10 days before the election. So I think there's a significantly higher turnout for predominantly for Democrats. And I think that will probably be a factor. But there's a part of me that always thinks that Donald Trump's just going to pull it out of the bag somehow.
Yeah, I mean, he has had a bit of a shocker of a campaign, really. I mean, you know, although you may argue that it's not his fault that he contracted COVID, his handling of the crisis has been sort of somewhat all over the place. But, you know, and the first debate was obviously a shambles. The debate last night was much better. And, you know, the consensus was that sort of Trump won that. You know, has he got that potential to pull it out of the bag, or has he simply left it too late?
I think he does. I mean, when we talk about sort of what we think is going to happen versus what we feel is going to happen, it's always tricky. But I have a feeling that Trump could win, and that's not based on data, obviously, because the data is telling us otherwise. It's just based on a sense that, as last time, I think there's probably a significant portion of people in the United States who would not admit to voting for Donald Trump right now, and that will be a factor. And I think there might be a lot of people who will quietly vote for Donald Trump without admitting it.
Thanks, Neil. Now we're going to run through three of the areas which both of the candidates differ in opinions. First, the economy and the recovery from coronavirus.
We built the greatest economy in history. We closed it down because of the China plague. When the plague came in, we closed it down, which was very hard psychologically to do. He didn't think we should close it down, and he was wrong. When you start shutting it down, you take a look at what's happening at some of your Democrat-run states where they have these tough shutdowns. They're hurting people. People know what to do. They can social distance. They can wash their hands. They can wear masks. They can do whatever they want. But they got to open these states up.
You folks living in Scranton and Claymont and all the small towns and working class towns in America, how well are you doing?
I'm running as a proud Democrat, but I'm going to be an American president. I don't see red states and blue states. What I see is American, United States. And folks, every single state out there finds themselves in trouble. They're going to start laying off, whether they're red or blue, cops, firefighters, first responders, teachers, because they have to balance their budget. And the founders were smart. They allowed the federal government to deficit spend to compensate for the United States of America.
So, a lot of conflicting opinions there. Here's Neil Wilson to explain what it all means.
Increasingly, what we've seen is the chance of a blue wave happening, that they'll take the Senate, that the Democrats will also take the Senate as well. And there's obviously big market implications for that. And I think it's been interesting to see sort of in the news and the kind of the analyst comments and so on that I think it was Bank of America came out a few weeks ago with something saying that a blue wave had suddenly become this sort of consensus bullish catalyst. So the idea that suddenly you get loads and loads of stimulus from Congress, you know, you've got a united Congress, White House, everyone singing from the same hymn sheet. They're going to unleash a vast amount of stimulus, COVID stimulus, and then also massive spending plans as well. And that will juice the economy, and that will juice stock markets. But then that's kind of overlooked some of the key risks that we still think are in the market for the market, and particularly for equities that would come from a Joe Biden Democrat tax plans, which could significantly increase volatility after the election and could significantly reduce the upside for US stocks.
Okay. You mentioned earlier that, you know, as it looked more likely that Biden would triumph, that we potentially have this blue wave, that the market, which had initially obviously looked at the Democrats as some kind of threat to American prosperity and the continued performance of its stock markets, has actually switched that narrative. Are people just making up narratives to suit what's happening at the time now to kind of support the continued bullish view of stock markets?
I think fundamentally, yeah, that's it. There's a lot of narratives being made up to suit. I think that's entirely accurate. I mean, the thing is that with the way that the Fed sits and the amount of stimulus that is undoubtedly coming, whether it's Republican or Democrat, it's a vast amount that we're talking about, and it's very supportive to equity markets to keep the cost of cash down and to inject that kind of amount of money into the system. There's nowhere else for it to go except equities. But I think the problem with the Biden and blue wave, as I say, is the tax. I mean, the capital gains tax increase that could happen, you know, you're looking at it going from, I think it's around 20% up to 40% or something like that. And what that would mean if it were backdated to January 2nd, and this is what's one of my favorite guys that I follow, Paul Tudor Jones, who's probably known to some investors. He's a very successful macro investor, and he was stressing yesterday that, you know, it's very much going to weigh on a lot of the 1% who own these stocks. They're going to think they're going to need to liquidate ahead of that date, and that would create a lot of volatility post election. But then what you've got coming in the new year would be this vast amount of stimulus, which could be worth 10% of GDP again. What happened last time with that? It put money in people's bank accounts, which then they put into stocks. So you could then get a rally at the start of the year again after some selling going into Christmas.
Secondly, an issue which is never far from the political sphere, healthcare.
We have 180 million people out there that have great private healthcare. Far more than we're talking about with Obamacare. Joe Biden is going to terminate all of those policies. These are people that love their health care, people that have been successful, middle-income people, been successful. They have 180 million plans, 180 million people, families. Under what he wants to do, which will basically be socialized medicine, he won't even have a choice. They want to terminate 180 million plans. We have done an incredible job on health care. And we're going to do even better.
I have a follow-up for you, Vice President sure. Biden. It relates to something that President Trump said. He's accusing you of wanting socialized medicine. What do you say to people who have concerns that your health care plan, which includes a government insurance option, takes the country one step closer to a health care system run entirely by the government? What's your response to
them? I say it's ridiculous. It's like saying that, you know, we're the idea that the fact that there's a public option that people can choose, that makes it a socialist plan. Look, the difference between the president, I think health care is not a privilege, it's a right. Everyone should have the right to have affordable health care. And I am very proud of my plan. It's gotten endorsed by all the major labor unions as well as a whole range of other people who, in fact, are concerned in the medical field.
So, yeah, healthcare is a massive issue in the US, obviously a very different system than the one that we're used to in the UK. Works very well for many, many people, but very, very badly for many, many others. So, yeah, a political hot potato, as it always is here, but perhaps even more so in the US.
Yeah, it really is. It's massive in the US, the politics around it. And partly that comes down to regulation and regulation around drugs prices as well. I mean, drugs prices is always a hotly debated topic around election time, and again this time round, Donald Trump, although we didn't have it in that clip, is talking a lot about how the cost of prescription drugs has come down, and he's actually correct. The average monthly cost of prescription drugs fell. It fell 0.3%, not very much, but it has fallen under his leadership.
Yeah, but I think Joe Biden wants it to fall even further. And that was something that he actually brought up in the debate. He wants insurance premiums reduced. He wants drug prices reduced further by opening up competition a bit more. There potentially some pain to come for the healthcare industry if the Democrats get in.
This is something that's said every time, though.
I know. And
they haven't really had much success. And that's something that actually Lauren talks about in her history piece this week on funding the president, the fact that the pharmaceutical industry always has a little bit of funding going on for both presidential candidates means that they do find it really difficult to regulate the industry because they're being bankrolled by the pharmaceutical industry. But yeah, that's one of the reasons why time after time again, the US struggles to control drugs prices in a way that the UK manages to do.
Yeah, as we discussed in our cover feature this week. And in fact, we looked at lots of comparisons of international healthcare systems this week, including the US. And actually, on a lot of metrics, the US system looks absolutely terrible.
Yeah, which is really extraordinary considering how much they spend on it.
Well, they spend a lot more than anyone else per capita, about $10,000. The UK, by comparison, spends about four, funding the NHS largely. Life expectancy is shorter. They have more adults with chronic conditions, the most obese nation in the world. This is not an advert for a working healthcare system, really.
No, it's really, really not. And I suppose that's a reason why, I mean, it comes back as well to what we talked about in our feature in terms of what is healthcare and the US struggles because it does have an extremely overweight and extremely unhealthy population, it's difficult to care for people who need so much of it. And in the US, they really do.
Absolutely. Perhaps it's, as we discussed in the feature, not the healthcare system that the answer is, but healthcare, but lifestyle choices.
Yes, absolutely. Which I think maybe is probably out of the hands of both of these candidates. I don't really hear them talking much about lifestyle choices. It's maybe a slightly controversial topic in a nation which is so overweight. And actually, a lot of the states that really matter, Florida, for example, it's not a particularly healthy state. So they're unlikely to go around starting to preach about healthy living when they rely so much on voters in those crucial swing states. Healthcare is not something realistically that's going to be resolved by the next president, if ever, in the US.
I would agree with that.
And finally, perhaps the most divisive topic of them all, climate change.
Climate change, climate warming, global warming is an existential threat to humanity. We have a moral obligation to deal with it. And we're told by all the leading scientists in the world, we don't have much time.
So we have the Trillion Trees program. We have so many different programs. I do love the environment, but what I want is the cleanest, crystal clear water. Look at China, how filthy it is. Look at Russia. Look at India. It's filthy. The air is filthy. The Paris Accord, I took us out because we were going to have to spend trillions of dollars, and we were treated very unfairly. When they put us in there, they did us a great disservice. They were going to take away our businesses. I will not sacrifice tens of millions of jobs, thousands and thousands of companies because of the Paris Accord.
The Green New Deal will pay for itself as we move forward. We're not going to build plants that, in fact, are great polluting plants.
But do you
We're
support the Green New Deal?
Pardon me?
Do you support?
No, I don't support the Green New Deal.
Oh, you don't? Oh, well, that's a big statement.
I support you.
Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate here and say that Donald Trump actually does make some relatively sensible points about the fact that Russia and China and India are the world's biggest polluters, and the biggest climate issues that the world is facing are actually out of his hands.
Yeah, I think that is true to a large extent. However, he has to accept that America itself is a very large economy, has some very heavy industries there, has a very large extractive industry, both mining, hydrocarbons, fracking, for example, a very contentious industry, which many have accused of environmental damage over the years. And obviously just a very large number of consumers driving cars and consuming goods. So yeah, America has to play its part as well. And obviously we know that it refused to sign up to the Paris Climate Accord, which was, you know, many criticised Donald Trump for.
Yeah, well, and that's something that he's sticking to his guns with, and that's a lot about how much the being part of the Paris Climate Agreement would cost America, and how his argument is that he could spend that money more wisely on American industry and making American industry cleaner. But yeah, you're right, he's not doing very much to make the US any cleaner, and maybe that is because he is a bit of a climate change denier, perhaps.
I mean, I think what his main concern is that if you impose heavy environmental regulation on business, that you will essentially put thousands and thousands of jobs at risk. And actually, as we see here as well, you know, it's very easy to talk about greening your country. It's very easy for politicians to stand up and say, we're going to run everything off solar. We're going to all be driving electric cars. Actually making that a reality is very, very different.
Mm, yeah, it definitely is. And that's something that Joe Biden maybe gets a little bit confused about when he talks about the Green New Deal. He said the Green New Deal calls for the elimination of non-renewables. It actually doesn't. The Green New Deal, which is proposed by the left wing of the Democrat Party, they actually want net zero emissions, which is a different thing to no non-renewables. Net zero emissions is a more doable target, and that's more about making sure that the energy that you are, the bad energy that you are emitting is being offset by other good initiatives.
Non-renewables. If you eliminated non-renewables by 2030, you probably wouldn't have an airline industry. So that is a little bit
or
silly.
A shipping industry, or a fashion industry.
Or
so, yeah, he's wrong that that's what the Green New Deal is proposing, but he is potentially right in taking a slightly more central view and a slightly more sensible view that we are not going to eliminate this waste immediately because it's just not something that the modern world can live without.
Yeah, but this is an economic problem, really. This does tie into the economy. These discussions have been had over here as well. It's the transition that matters and how that takes place. And, you know, if Trump is not willing to move quickly and Biden is promising to move too quickly, you know, there is something in the middle that's going to be the reality.
And there was talked about a lot around the start of coronavirus when the world first went into lockdown, how it might be an opportunity to press reset on the climate emergency and actually start spending money in the right way where the climate is involved. And that's why the Green New Deal has come out. It's obviously a play on the New Deal, which was used to help America's economy recover after the last major financial crisis. And perhaps it is a sensible plan to think about. We are in a period of recovery, or America will be in a period of recovery anyway in the coming 4 years. Is it a time to start really pushing for major environmental change?
Yeah, I do wonder how many voters actually care, though. I've seen the trucks they drive around in.
Well, yeah, and again, it comes back to the most important states, and potentially those states, they care less than the states like California, which is never going to be anything other than Democrats, which do care about the environment, but really that state doesn't matter so much in the grand scheme of the votes.
Indeed. So the Americans go to the polls on the 3rd of November. Hopefully sometime soon after that, we'll know who the next president will be. There's likely to be lots more twists and turns on the way over the next couple of weeks. We may have given you insight into what some of them may be in the page of the Investors Chronicle in recent weeks. You can look at our 5-part series there, looking in detail at various aspects of the US election. We've looked at media, we've looked at technology, we've looked at healthcare, and we've looked at politics more generally and what it means for markets. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Megan, and we'll be back soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real, frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club, with me, Maisie Williams. And each week, we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics, all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.